More stimulus on the way from the Fed? Well, keep an eye on the data.
And Mitt Romney unveils his new energy plan, a look at what the impact might be. Hello, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Thursday, August 23rd. Lots of good stuff coming up, including the first of a two-part series we're going to do. There are two very prominent economic forecasting models, or let's just say forecasting models for presidential elections, Stacey, where you look at the data and predict who's going to win. So two models that say very different things about the 2012 election. We're going to do them kind of a 1-2 punch today and tomorrow. First up, something called the bread and peace model.
And a bit later in the show, we take a look at some of the perks that state workers in China are seeing, things like mortgage payments, groceries, and fancy cars, all tax-free. That's coming up a little bit later on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
There are new signs the Federal Reserve might be ready for another round of stimulating the U.S. economy. There was no action from the latest Fed meeting, but newly released minutes from that meeting suggest the board is open to buying up more bonds and maybe mortgage-backed securities. From Washington, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
So here's a tasty nugget from the Fed minutes. Quote, many members judge that additional monetary accommodation would likely be warranted fairly soon. Why? The meeting noted that U.S. economic activity had decelerated. Hiring and manufacturing were soft, as was the global economy. The upshot? Quincy Crosby at Prudential Financial says many traders think the question is not if QE3, but when. Also, what type of bonds would the Fed buy?
They sometimes joke that they may have to buy James Bond when all is said and done. They buy any bonds they want. And they have also been big buyers of mortgage-backed securities. If the Fed decides to focus on mortgage-backed securities, you're going to see interest rates and mortgage rates come down much more.
But, of course, Crosby notes it's not a done deal. The economy could speed up. And QE3 opponents of the Fed argue that buying bonds to nudge down interest rates is just a short-term fix. A week from tomorrow, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke speaks to central bankers around the world. That's the next tea leaf. Read away. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Investors got all excited over the possibility of another round of federal stimulus bond buying after some minutes were released from a Federal Reserve meeting earlier this month. However, we got news this morning from the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis that those minutes are dated and the U.S. economy has turned around. That's got people thinking no stimulus, and the markets love their stimulus. They are not loving the no stimulus possibility. Hmm. Jeff, you always see this correlation. The Dow looks like it's down about 0.5%. The Nasdaq and S&P also down about the same.
Stocks are headed for a lower close in Europe. French President François Hollande travels to Berlin today. He's going to meet with his German counterpart, Angela Merkel. The Greek prime minister will join them tomorrow. And Greece wants an extra 2 years to get its fiscal house in order, basically make the government budget cuts that Germany and others have required as a condition of the Greek bailout. And Germany's finance minister today, though, signaled he's skeptical of that pitch for extra time. However, Stacey, Germany's finance minister today signaled he's just a little bit skeptical of that pitch for extra time. But it sounds like Greece may have some other ideas up its sleeve. This was big on Twitter this morning and then finally verified on the actual news wires, so we know it's true. In an interview with the French newspaper Le Monde, which is coming out tomorrow, the Greek prime minister says he is open to privatizing, commercializing, maybe even selling some of Greece's many uninhabited or undeveloped islands.
Really?
As a way of raising some money. He puts it this way, very delicately, transforming unused terrain into capital that could generate revenue at a fair price.
In other words, want to buy a Greek island?
I know there could be some coming on the market.
Well, to the U.S. now, where the number of people filing for unemployment benefits rose last week, and activity in U.S. manufacturing slowed for the first part of this month. Also, on the campaign trail, President Barack Obama's campaign announced it's preparing to start taking campaign donations via text message. And meanwhile, later today, GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney will officially unveil his energy plan at a campaign stop in New Mexico. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports on what that could mean.
You don't need to wait for the speech to hear Romney's energy philosophy. In short, he wants less regulation and more energy exploration. If elected president, though, he still won't control all the levers of power. Lauren O'Neill tracks policy for Energy Intelligence Group.
When candidates make promises, not all of them can be achieved if they can't get the support of Congress. But two areas where they can make a difference on their own is with the Interior Department and the EPA.
Even without Congress, a Romney Interior Department could clear new oil and gas drilling from Alaska to the Atlantic. And a Romney-run EPA could soften or delay environmental rule enforcement. But don't expect to feel the impact in your wallet. Doug Reynolds is an energy economist at University of Alaska Fairbanks.
I doubt there'll be much change. You're not going to change the price of oil.
That will still rise and fall with global markets. There's not enough oil in America to stop that. And electricity prices won't move much because natural gas is already pretty cheap. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Seems like we've got a new poll on the presidential race almost every week, every day practically.
That's right? True.
One getting a lot of buzz this morning is a new NBC Wall Street Journal poll. So it's legit, right? But it suggests that Mitt Romney is having some trouble with the African-American vote. His official support, Stacey, among blacks in this poll is 0%.
0%. That's bad.
A little unsettling for his campaign. I suspect, of course, there are blacks who support Mitt Romney, but this is a rounding issue. They're rounding down. Some economists and others, maybe for this very reason, like to set the polls aside and head straight for the data. And their goal, when they do this, is to isolate which critical factors determine who wins presidential elections. And then they use these forecasting models to project a winner.
Huh.
So this year, I found this very interesting. Two of the best-known models out there, both with very strong track records, come to completely different conclusions. And we're going to do one model today and the other one tomorrow. Today, we've got Douglas Hibbs. He is the father of the so-called bread and peace model. He's recently retired as chair of the economics department at Sweden's University of Gothenburg. Good to talk with you.
Happy to be here.
You have one of the simplest models around, but it's been very successful. What do you factor in?
Well, my model asserts that the only systematic factors persistently affecting presidential election results are the weighted average growth of real disposable personal income over the term of office and the number of fatalities of American forces involved in unprovoked foreign conflicts.
Just those two factors. What about everything else?
Well, everything else potentially can matter, but not in a systematic or persistent fashion. The other stuff tends to be particular to individual elections.
So, Romney versus Obama, 2012, what does the bread and peace model say?
Well, the point estimate is 47.5 percentage points for the incumbent Obama of the major party vote. So, in the aggregate, if idiosyncratic factors, say, favored Obama by two standard errors, he could comfortably win. He'd be up above 52%. The likelihood of that, I think, is small, around 1 in 10, perhaps a little less than 1 in 10, something like that.
So setting aside the Electoral College, which can do weird things to anybody's model, your model suggests that Obama is likely to lose.
Correct, with quite high probability.
You believe pretty strongly that your model's going to get it right this time?
No, if I get it exactly right, it'll be a stroke of great good luck.
You know, of course, if you get it exactly right, but let's talk about the outcome that matters. Winners and losers.
Well, as I said, my model implies that Obama will lose with fairly high probability, but it's probabilistic. 1 in 10 or so chance of him winning is, you know, is not a negligible chance after all, right? It's not negligible at all.
Since disposable personal income growth is so important to your model, how strong would that growth have to be, say, at the time of the election for the president to prevail?
Well, it's late in the day, and of course, the economy has performed very poorly under Obama, and rightly or wrongly, he owns the economy. In order for him to eke out a victory, growth would really have to ratchet up to 6% or higher.
Economist Douglas Hibbs, inventor and maintainer of the Bread and Peace election forecasting model. Good to talk with you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And Stacey, it seems like this comes up every election cycle, multiple times. Campaigns choose songs for their rallies.
Oh, I know.
They want to get everybody pumped up.
They destroy songs, you know.
Well,
they do.
If you're the creator of that song, you are entitled to your opinion about that, of course. And musicians aren't always crazy about being drafted for the cause. The latest people are talking about today is Dee Snider. You know who Dee Snider is?
No.
He is the cross-dressing lead singer for Twisted Sister.
Oh, right. Someone used his song?
They did. Well,
wow, that's controversial.
Here we go. We're not going to take it. No, we're not going to take it, right? That's a great campaign song, potentially, especially if you're trying to unseat an incumbent president. The campaign of Republican vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan has been blasting "We're Not Going to Take It" to fire up crowds. And Snyder does not like that very much, and so he told him to knock it off. And a Ryan spokesman wrote back to Snyder, apparently this is true, in an email, short and sweet, "We're not going to play it anymore." That's nice.
That's nice. And speaking of songs, Jeff.
Okay.
A story for everyone's inner cowboy. Are you a fan of the Old West at all, Jeff?
I spent some of my formative years in Montana, so...
Oh, you did?
I did the West, yeah.
Oh, well, as an Idahoan, I have great appreciation for that.
Next door neighbor.
And apparently we're not alone. Energy billionaire William Koch is building his own Old West town near Aspen, Colorado.
Building it. Not your,
yes.
Not your typical ghost town attraction then, huh?
But it's he's doing it upright. There's going to be a jail, a train station, of course, you know, a saloon because
yep.
You cannot have an Old West town without a saloon.
And a saloon piano player over in the corner.
Exactly. And he's actually, Koch has long been a collector of Western artifacts. He has the only known photograph of Billy the Kid.
Huh.
Yeah. But tragically, Western fans that we are, we will not be able to go and visit this place. It's private property. It will only be open to friends and family.
Oh, come on.
I don't know. This town ain't big enough for all of us.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Some not-so-great economic news out of China this morning, Jeff. A major manufacturing index for the country fell to a 9-month low. It's being seen as another sign that the world's second-largest economy is slowing.
Not that everybody is suffering there. Workers at state-run companies in China are riding pretty high. And we're not just talking salaries. There are often a lot of perks for state workers. Mortgage payments, groceries, fancy cars, all of that tax-free. Here's Marketplace's China correspondent Rob Schmitz.
In the Yangtze Delta city of Changzhou, an employee of a state-owned enterprise tries to explain her salary to me. Yes, tries. It's confusing, even to her.
I make $150 a month for my base salary. Then I make $50 for my scale pay. Then there's $200 for my performance pay. Then there's my traffic subsidy, my housing stipend.
She's reading from her monthly paycheck. It's a foot long, and it's divided into dozens of compensation categories. It's like this for 65 million employees in China's thriving state sector. This employee asked not to be named. That's because she's talking about one of the dirtiest secrets among workers at government-run companies, perks.
Many companies offer automobiles, houses. They even pay for gym memberships for their executives. And this should all get counted as income for employees, but it doesn't.
Sean Ryan is the author of the book The End of Cheap China. He says there's a reason a monthly paycheck in China looks like calculus homework.
What happens is a lot of companies will use benefits as a tax write-off, which is why you have a lot of employees who make $300 a month driving Bentleys, because the companies are able to use the purchase price of the Bentley as a 100% tax write-off.
With visions of company-issued Bentleys dancing in their heads, top Chinese college graduates are increasingly choosing jobs at state-owned enterprises over multinationals. Back in Changzhou, this state employee says next month the government's going to scrap her complicated salary scheme for something it's calling a sunshine salary policy. This will be a relief for economists in China. It's been difficult to track who's making what and how they're spending it, making many wonder how much of China's economy is off the books. Still, it's hard to know how much sunlight these new government policies will shine onto China's massive hidden economy. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
And speaking of paydays, all week here at Marketplace, we've been looking into the world of the paycheck from all income levels, regions, and walks of life. Head to marketplace.org to take a quiz on whether your bosses view your job as more commodity or customized good. Or try the future Jobs-O-Matic tool and see what kind of staying power your chosen career really has.
And if you find your way to that commodity or customized good quiz, the terminology they chose, our web folks, is very interesting. Are you a pork belly or are you a sausage? And on that note, meat company Hormel released its latest quarterly earnings this morning.
Maker of Spam.
Yes. Hormel is the third largest seller of meat in the U.S. They say sales and profits are up, and the company says its outlook is unchanged. But with the drought in the Midwest pushing food prices up, investors are looking to this purveyor of processed meat, Hormel, for hints about the food industry's long-term health. Marketplace's Queena Kim has that story.
When you hear Hormel, you think Spam, Dinty Moore, or other canned foods. But today, Hormel's biggest moneymaker is turkey.
Turkey breast, turkey burger, turkey franks.
And they sell whole turkeys, too. Tim Ramey is an analyst at D.A. Davidson. About 30% of Hormel's business comes from Jenny O, its turkey brand. Ramey says with the Midwest drought driving up corn prices, turkey prices will rise too.
You make turkey out of corn, and there's no doubt that it will be expensive going forward.
But don't worry about Thanksgiving dinner, says Akshay Jagdale, a food and beverage analyst at KeyBank. Hormel's been smart about buying corn in advance. The question is, has the company locked in prices for next year?
It's more likely that we see it next year rather than this year.
So you might want to put an extra bird in the freezer for next Thanksgiving. I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
We talk a lot on this program about which industries are making and losing money. But what about likability? Which industries have the best reputation? That's our topic for this week's installment of Attitude Check, our partnership with Gallup.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Gallup's editor-in-chief Frank Newport joins me now. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning.
So, Frank, tell me, which industries had the best image among the people that you polled?
Well, you know, in the movie The Graduate, the word was plastics. Word today is, that's right, remember, the advice to young Dustin Hoffman, Benjamin Braddock. The word now is computers. This is very fascinating. We give people 25 business and industry sectors, read them the names, and simply say, is your immediate reaction positive or negative? And when we say computer industry, 73% of Americans say their immediate reaction is positive, and that's by far the highest of any of the 25 that we test. So that's the place to be if you want to be in an industry that is revered by the average American.
What were some of the other top contenders?
Well, you know, other things relating to computers, the internet industry was up there as well. And interestingly, we said, quote, the retail industry, and that came up this year, and that's up there in the top five or the top six. But others were anything related to food, restaurant industry, farming and agriculture, grocery industry, all of those were up there in the top five or six. So people simply like anybody that seems to be involved in the food production chain, which is quite interesting.
What about the other end of the spectrum? Which industries had the worst images?
Well, it's a battle between the federal government, which was dead last year. It has moved up to second from last this year. It is the oil and gas industry, which is dead last, which is quite interesting. You know, a lot of people in the oil and gas industry, hey, we do a great job of providing you fuel every day, but we're down to the point where only 22% of Americans say they have a positive reaction. We hear those words, the oil and gas industry. And keep in mind, we were in the field doing this interviewing a couple of weeks ago when gas prices were on the rise up. And I think that's why Americans have a negative reaction, because of the spike ups and downs in gas prices.
And finally, Frank, were there any big differences that you noticed between last year and this year?
Well, one of the changes was healthcare industry, which is up this year. It's not highly revered on a relative basis, but for whatever reason, maybe the Supreme Court decision on the Affordable Care Act, that is up. Banking, which really suffered after 2008, has been kind of up and down, but it's dropped again this year, and it's actually third from lowest. The banking industry is higher only than the federal government and oil and gas.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief at Gallup. Frank, thank you.
My pleasure.
And, Jeff, the English language has some brand new additions today.
Well, color me flurber-blurstered.
That is not one of them, tragically.
Bummer.
The online version of the Oxford English Dictionary has released a list of official new words today.
All right, hit me.
Okay, tweeps.
Sure.
Okay, so that's a person.
I use it. I'm glad it's official now.
For those who may not know, it's a person's followers on the social networking site Twitter. Those are your tweeps. Another word, soul patch.
Ah, I have had one for years. No,
seriously?
That's not true.
Okay. That's a person's tiny, like those little micro beards.
Apollo Ono has a notable soul patch.
He totally has a soul patch.
Yeah.
Also, radic.
That I have never applied in my life.
Short for ridiculous.
is redonkulous in there? But from previous years, I guess. Ridic is a is that a shortened version of redonkulous, or that would just be redonk?
I think that would be redonk.
We'll
yeah, no, I think this is. I think you're ahead of your time. Vocabularily,
I'm
going to
submit. Okay.
And then there was my favorite, which is mwahaha.
What?
The evil laugh.
That's not a word.
Actually, it is a word.
Oh, I think flibberbursted is as good a word as mwahaha.
Well, you're going to have to write the Oxford English Dictionary about that.
I'm coining it.
Flibberbursted.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, and this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.